Thanks so much for being with us, Carl.
Sure, my pleasure.
This is excellent to be able to speak to someone who's done so much amazing work on the topic of Buddha nature and all of the texts of Maitreya, the five great texts of Maitreya. So the first question I'd like to ask is the simplest, I think.
Seemingly,
exactly. So if you could, in just a few phrases, tell us, what is Buddha nature?
Well, I guess the other, you know, the textbook definitions of Buddha nature, you know, like whatever. Luminosity, emptiness, inseparable, empty of adventitious stains, not empty of qualities. I would say it's refers to the innate primordial freedom of the mind, which is naturally imbued with wisdom, compassion, power, and bliss.
Wow. That sounds really, really like an amazingly positive definition of Buddha nature.
Yes. And I think it should be.
Yeah. That's excellent. What do you think the purpose of Buddha nature teachings are for Tibetan Buddhism?
Well, if you look at the Uttara Tantra itself, which is the major source, Indian source, then it states the purpose clearly at the end of the fourth vajra point, end of the first chapter, which is overcoming five flaws. That is the, you know, official purpose, obviously. And if you look at those five flaws, that they cover a lot of ground. It's not just five little thingies, you know, like, you know, forgetting your teacup somewhere, but it's basically addressing the whole samsaric outlook and overcoming that. Especially the third and the fourth flaw is basically the like giving the adventitious stains undue existence wrongly, and as the flip side of that, to deny or, you know, underestimate ultimate reality. And that is, you know, not just a little flaw, that is the whole bedrock of what we call samsaric existence. So to overcome that, that's basically our wrong perception of what we perceive as samsara. That is, I would say, is the purpose of Buddha nature, which means it's a radical transformation of the entire outlook. As Maitreya said it in his several of his texts, actually, he says, you know, it's amazing, this darkness of ignorance compared to ordinary darkness, because in ordinary darkness you just don't see what's there, but in the mental darkness of samsara you not only don't see what's there, which is ultimate reality, but on top of that you see all kinds of things that aren't there. So it's a double darkness, and this is exactly what Buddha nature is overcoming, because it's always talking about penetrating the unreality of the adventitious stains, and at the same time realizing the other side of that, other side of the coin, which is all the precious qualities of the nature of the mind. So I think that's, in terms of the view, that's fundamental for both Sutrayana and even more so for Tantra, because that's what the whole tantric tradition is based on. That's why in the Kagyu tradition we call the Uttara Tantra the bridge between Sutra and Tantra, and it's very clear in terms of the view. And then I think in terms of practice, it also has tremendous impact on the whole view of the path and what purification and all those kinds of things are, because without Buddha nature, on the path, fundamentally, you have two jobs, which means you have to purify the obscurations and then you have to create the qualities of a Buddha. But on the Buddha nature, at least on the disclosure model, where it said the qualities already exist naturally, even in sentient beings, then you only have one job, which means once you purify the adventitious stains, that's it, because the qualities are already there. So you could say, you know, that makes life so much easier. So purifying what obscures is enough to for what is already there in terms of natural qualities to be revealed, rather than having to create it. So I think that's a tremendous impact on the whole outlook of what the path is about.
Right. So is the teachings on Buddha nature, they on the one hand seem fundamental, basic, obvious in a sense that you have to, if you posit enlightenment, if you posit Buddhas, if there is that truth that you can become a Buddha, then some teaching about Buddha nature seems essential. But on another side, it's kind of a radical teaching, and seems sometimes to be in opposition to teachings about emptiness. So what do you think about that? Is this a radical teaching or a kind of basic piece of Buddhism?
Well, in a sense, you could say it's radical, which you also can see from how it was dealt with, at least in early Indian Buddhism. Because even in the Yogacara tradition, which some people think, oh yeah, they're all in bed with Buddha nature from the beginning, and this is actually not the case. If you look at the early Yogacara, classical Yogacara writings, whether it's Asanga, Vasubandhu, Sthiramati, Asvabhava, all those guys, without exception, when it comes to Buddha nature, and they rarely talk about it, but when they talk about it, all say it's nothing other than dogme, like anatman, twofold anatman. That's it. So they're not going into any talk about like what the Uttara Tantra does actually. Of course, except for in the Ratnagotra Vibhaga Vyakya, which is another problem whether it's really by Asanga or not. But apart from that, it's very clear in the Yogacara tradition, even that they obviously considered it as a, you know, don't, let's not get anywhere near it being like an Atman. So of course that changed later with, you know, later Yogacaras like Ratnakara Shanti and people like that. And then of course in Tibet with the whole Shentong business. But I think it's, yeah, it is radical because it questions fundamentally the whole outlook of who we are and also what it means to be on the path and what the fruition is like. And the most radical, I think, presentation is in actually in some teachings where it is said that, like for example, third and eighth Kamapa and also a few other places I have seen that it's so radical that it actually says it's not that sentient beings have Buddha nature, like they don't own it. It's actually something that's completely different from anything a sentient being is, and that is very radical. And they even go to the extent of saying it's not that sentient beings have obscurations, they are the obscurations. So that is very radical, right? Because I mean, who wants to be an obscuration? It's not very flattering. But I think when you think about it, it's extremely profound, because what is a sentient being? It's the five skandhas. And that is exactly what obscures Buddha nature. It's made very clear in the Buddha nature text. So it's radical in the sense that basically in order to become a Buddha, you actually have to say goodbye to yourself, like to yourself and the world as you know it. Like you have to go out of existence as a sentient being to become a Buddha. So from that point of view, it's not even that a sentient being becomes a Buddha. It come up as says very clearly that's actually impossible, because that would be like saying clouds become the cloud-free sky, which is not happening. No, you have to get rid of the clouds in order to experience the cloud-free sky. So in that sense, yes, it is extremely radical. And of course it sounds like, you know, more schmoozy if you say all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Then you can still entertain some kind of notion, oh yeah, that's my true self or something like that, but that's actually, when you really look at it, that's not the case at all. And from that point of view, then it's also is clear that Buddha nature is not some kind of Atman. So it takes care of that problem too.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit about your book, When the Clouds Part?
Sure. Well, like some other of my books, it started out with a rather modest scope and then it mushroomed. Because as I went along, you know, doing research and stuff, my original motivation was actually to, you know, investigate two things, like what is called the Gomluk, of the five Maitreya texts, as opposed to the Sheluk meditative tradition of the five Maitreya texts, and particularly the Uttara Tantra, because I've always heard about that, but I've never really encountered any texts, you know, that actually deal with that. And the other one was that statement, famous statement that's attributed to Gampopa, where he says, this Mahamudra of ours is the Uttara Tantra by the Viksha Maitreya. And yeah, so, and then from there it mushroomed, because then I actually, partly with the help of some other people, I found, like Klaus Dieter Matthes pointed out, one of the Kadampa texts that actually uses the Uttara Tantra as a kind of, you know, basis for meditation instructions. And there's not only one of them, there's a number of them which are in the book that use the Uttara Tantra as a basis for Mahamudra style pointing out instruction, which backs up that statement, supposedly by Gampopa. It's not in any of his preserved works, but is quoted, of course, everywhere. But it makes sense. And then, of course, it went to, okay, so where did Gampopa get that idea, if he actually said it, or how did it come about at all? And then, of course, you look at Matt Tripa, who supposedly rediscovered the Uttara Tantra and the Dharma Dhamma Tavibhaga. And then, interestingly, in his works, you find almost nothing about the Uttara Tantra. Like, he quotes it, I think, two or three times, very briefly, but no explanation. And then that led to his students, and interestingly, one of his students, Vajrapani, in one of his texts, he explains, you know, the famous verse about there's nothing to be added, nothing to be removed. And that is very interesting, both from a Madhyamika point of view and then from a more Vajrayana point of view. And so, yeah, I was, you know, trying to trace the lineages, and then also Sean actually kindly pointed out, she said to me one time, oh, did you know there was a commentary on the Uttara Tantra by Marpa? I said, no, I've never heard that before. And then I said, yeah, but I'm very interested, please send me a copy. So he did, and it was published in a collection of the Drikung Kaji works by His Holiness Tretsang Rinpoche. And then when I looked at it, and then it was pretty obvious that it was not by the Marpa, it was another Marpa who is not that well known, but who lived at the same time, coincidentally, and he wrote this, no, one of his students wrote this commentary based on his teachings. He was also a student of Naropa, actually, and mainly in Naropa's four Indian students. And those two actually even met, like the two Marpas, briefly. They both went to India. Marpa Trigi Wangchuk is his name. And so that commentary introduction also is total Mahamudra pointing out instructions. It even uses the word pointing out, based on the Uttara Tantra. So there's another interesting piece there. And then, of course, I was interested in the relationship between Yogacara and Buddha nature. So I'm talking about that too. And the relationship between Uttara Tantra and Buddha nature teachings and Mahamudra, which, of course, Klaus Dieter Matthes did a lot of work on Gyalotsava's commentary. And I also included some of that in there. And relationship of Mahamudra to Uttara Tantra in other works, mainly by Kadri masters. So you see it mushroomed quite a bit.
And what would you say is the, can you kind of summarize the book for us in some basic sense? Not in great detail, but.
Yeah. Well, I would say it's kind of a, it's essentially on the meditative tradition of the five Maitreya texts and the Uttara Tantra in particular, and then the relationship to Mahamudra, Yogacara, and then the also how it was transmitted in the Kadampa, early Kadampa tradition, because that's where all these texts are, or a lot of them that use Uttara Tantra as basis for pointing out instruction, Mahamudra style, which was surprising because it's didn't expect that to find in the Kadampa tradition. So I think those are the main areas where I think it contributes something to that was not commonly known before. So, and of course, I guess in general you could say it's like a comprehensive manual on Buddha nature. So yeah, of course, then the the translation of the Uttara Tantra and the Ratnagotra Vibhaga Vyakya from Sanskrit, that also is a key part of it, which I've forgot before, because I mean Takasaki did great work, but I think it was a little bit outdated translation. So I try to come up with another one, also using Schmidhausen's and Van der Kuip. They're working on the Sanskrit text, you know. And so, yeah.
So in that book, you have actually 10 translations included, right? Quite a bit of work that hadn't been done before. And then you also have this massive introduction that lays out a lot of the sources and lists of all the sutra sources and lists of lists from different Tibetan masters. What are the true sources of Buddha nature teachings? And
yeah, that's another part, which sutras actually talk about Buddha nature in any significant way. And it's actually not many. Right. I think it all boils down to 8.
Just 8 sources. Wow, interesting. Great. So let's see. I think it would be interesting to hear a little bit more about the connection to Vajrayana practice and Buddha nature teachings, and that, as you talked about, the bridge between sutra and tantra.
Yeah, I guess one thing I mentioned already, you know, one job instead of two. And then, Vajrayana is called the fruitional jnana, and when you look at the Buddha nature teachings, I mean, from the get-go, it speaks about the fruition, actually, right? Especially when you come at it from a disclosure model point of view, the qualities are already there, which means that is the fruition. You just have to reveal that, and that's, at least in the Kagyu tradition, that's also the view. So you could, you know, kind of loosely say the idea in the Vajrayana from that point of view is, you know, fake it till you make it. Like, you're working with a fruition and you try to connect to it in some way as early as possible and as directly as possible. That's the whole idea of the Vajrayana. And at least from the Kagyu point of view, that's really only possible if there is already something to connect to begin with, not something that you have to create along the way, because then, strictly speaking, you can't really call it the fruitional vehicle, in my view at least. So in order to work with the fruition, then you need to look through what is called the obscurations, and then also realize that they actually never existed from the beginning, really, which is the whole, you could say that's the idea of the whole, like, Utpatikrama, Sampanakrama progression, because it becomes more and more rarefied as you go, both in terms of what you supposedly purify and also in terms of the methods that you apply, which tallies very nicely with the idea of you're not really working on the Buddha nature, because there's nothing to work on. It's already perfect. But what you're working on is what obscures it, which means the remedy is actually, and the obscurations, that's where their work happens, not on the level of actually the Buddha nature itself. And so that means both the obscurations and the remedy are part of the dualistic mind, and actually both from the point of view of Buddha nature are the obscurations. The remedies are also obscurations from point of view of Buddha nature. So the remedies need to be more and more refined as the obscurations become more and more subtle. But then in the end, you always have to give up the remedy as well, because otherwise you're still stuck in a dualistic mindset, which prevents you from realizing Buddha nature. And that's often said in the Mahamudra, Vajrayana, Dzogchen tradition, right? All these statements, there's really nothing to do, and we don't use remedies. You just have to recognize what is there, like whether you call it Rigpa, Buddha nature, ordinary mind, Tamil Gishepa, whatever it is, it's always very clear. It's already there. You just need to recognize it. So that tallies very much with the whole, as it is presented in the Uttara Tantra and the Buddha nature teachings. So it's the key point is recognition versus non-recognition, rather than actually removing something that obscures something else, or creating something that wasn't there. So the classical example, obviously, is the rope and the snake thing. Or you could say garden hose with zigzag pattern and the snake. So at any given time, the snake never existed, other than in the mind of the perceiver. So you can't really take away some snake that's lying on that rope and obscures it and put it somewhere else, and then you see the rope. It's rather to recognize, to take a good look and recognize that there never was a snake in the first place. And that's exactly what Maitreya says, right? You see something that doesn't exist, the snake or the obscurations, and through that you don't see what actually does exist, the rope or Buddha nature. So that's the, I think that's the key point in Vajrayana, Mahamudra, and Dzogchen. It's about recognition. And that's also what a lot of the instructions say. So it's not about removing anything, actually. It's more about seeing through. And that's why the obscurations are called adventitious, right? It's part of that. It's not only, does not only mean they are not intrinsic to Buddha nature, but it also means they're actually just fluff. There is no substance to them. And I think that's also a key point for Vajrayana, if you have that view, because like it also says, no matter what happens, no matter how many afflictions you have, it doesn't change the wisdom nature of the mind, or it doesn't change Rigpa, for example. And that can really be understood, I think, very nicely through if you have some familiarity with the Buddha nature theory, because that's what it says there too, and explains in great detail. So I think, and it also, I think, has a lot to do with devotion in the Vajrayana too, the whole idea of Buddha nature, because it also says in the Vajrayana that it's not enough just to have devotion to the guru, like as an outside entity, but it's equally important to have devotion to the inner guru, which is nothing other than Buddha nature. So it needs to be both, because otherwise it becomes some kind of, the guru has it all and I have nothing. And then it becomes a little bit theistic approach, like this higher being, and I need to get something which I don't have. Rather than, the nature of our mind is identical, only difference is that person has realized, I do not. But it's not that I actually get something from that I don't have, but they help me to realize what I do already have. And that's also a very different outlook on the whole path. So it's kind of, I think it's a nice antidote for poverty mentality, actually. Like hungry ghost, I need to get something I don't have. And flipping that around and seeing, I do have all these things, or strictly speaking, I don't, but they are there, with or without me. And then, the journey is more like one of discovery rather than, trying to get something extrinsic or, somewhere else. So I think, it's almost like a little koan. You could say it's about the question, what is my mind without me? That's what you're looking for. Or not you.
That's what the not you is looking for?
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Thank you for these explanations. It's really, really meaningful. One thing I thought would be nice to just comment on one of the most important passages from the what we might call the root text, the Uttara Tantra Shastra. So that chapter 1, verse 28, about the three reasons that all beings have, or all sentient beings have, Buddha nature. So in your book, you have a whole section where you go through all the different commentaries on that one particular verse, which is just amazing and provides so much context and information, and almost like a historical study of commentary on that one verse. So would you maybe give your own commentary on that verse and your own thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I, from the beginning, I had a little bit hard time to actually really accept the three lines there as actual, like, full-on logical, watertight reasons, you know. And obviously a lot of people share that sentiment. And so I was kind of, you know, amazed and in a sense relieved and to see that, you know, the Eighth Kamapa is basically launching a full-on attack and saying these reasons don't prove at all that sentient beings do have Buddha nature, and they also don't prove that sentient beings are Buddha nature either. So he goes in that whole spiel of, you know, Yerpa and Yinpa and Mepa and Minpa in Tibetan logic, you know. So he says you can, they neither apply in terms of Yerpa existence nor in terms of Yinpa, like being something. And I found that fascinating. And as I said before, he also has this stance, you know, that sentient beings are the obscuration. So from that point of view too, he says sentient beings cannot possess Buddha nature, because it would be like saying clouds possess the sky. And then also he, so, and that flipped my understanding around totally, because when we think about what does it mean all sentient beings do have Buddha nature, then I think most people, when they hear that, you know, I mean, of course, it sounds good, right? I mean, who wouldn't like that? But then what does it actually mean? And I think when you ask people, you know, just in terms of what does that feel like for you, then I think for most people it is, okay, Buddha nature is something within my body, somewhere, right? Like maybe at the heart or whatever. But what does that mean? Like when you think about it, it just means your Buddha nature is not even as big as your body. It's something smaller, right? Which is kind of defeating the whole purpose of, you know, limitlessness. So, and I think it's to flip it around is actually, I think, very profound. So, and also later then I found that in some texts too, which actually say that explicitly, that it's not that Buddha nature exists in sentient beings, but it's the other way around. Sentient beings exist in Buddha nature, which first sounds kind of strange, but then when you think about it, I think it makes a lot of sense, and it's also really profound, and it can turn around your view completely. So the example is more like sentient beings exist like clouds within the vast sky, like gloomy little clouds who don't look outside of them, just see their own little whatever. And so then when the clouds dissolve, then that's basically the larger reality of Buddha nature. So, and I think I understand the verse in that sense. And actually, when you look at the Uttara Tantra, you can find that too, because it talks a lot about space, like using that example, and that similar to the, you know, the world arising in space and the perishing, the skandhas also arise within the space of Buddha nature. So it actually says that, right? Like Buddha nature is the bigger thing, and then the sentient being is the small thing in there. So when you hear all sentient beings have Buddha nature, I think it's a provisional statement in that sense. It's not literally that sentient beings possess Buddha nature or even are Buddha nature. Buddha nature is much bigger. And and I think those three lines, they can be understood more as indications or pointing fingers to that, rather than being, you know, watertight reasonings where the three modes apply and the Kamapa goes through the whole thing and defeats every of those three modes, like in Tibetan debate style, you know. But I still think it's helpful, because it can be inspirational. And when you think about what these three lines mean, it looks at Buddha nature from different points of view, like from the point of fruition, that would be the first line, Dharmakaya, like Buddha-kaya, it's all pervasive or radiates. And then the second one is, it's the same in sentient beings and Buddhas, which means it doesn't change. And then the third was in terms of sentient beings, it's a potential, but not, at least from the disclosure model point of view, not something that actually grows, but it's something to be revealed. So if you look at it from that point of view, then if you really want to go deeper, I think that's a helpful way to think about it. And, you know, also kind of, you know, blow your mind in a good way, because then Buddha nature is not that little thing existing somewhere in your body or whatever, in your five skandhas. it's actually much bigger. And then in terms of practice, also that means that practice is not about finding something in your five skandhas, you know, that little treasure pearl there, but it's actually stepping out of your five skandhas into the vast space without the clouds.
Great. So you presented Buddha nature in a very positive light as a really key teaching, especially for Vajrayana practice. In some Buddhist traditions, it's seen in a more problematic way, or even in some traditions, it's rejected as non-Buddhist teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And there is sort of a thousand-year long-standing debate going on about what Buddha nature actually is and how it should be presented. What's the big deal there? What's the key issues, and what's the debate all about?
Well, I think the key issue is, you know, that it's, if you understand it in the wrong way, it's like an Atman, which is, of course, the big boogeyman in Buddhism. Like, nobody wants to go there, and that's exactly what happened. To my knowledge, there's no evidence that ever anybody in India said it's a non-Buddhist teaching. There's no evidence at all. And also in Tibet, nobody said that Buddha nature is not a Buddhist teaching. But the interpretation of what Buddha nature refers to differed greatly. And some people say, like, interpretations such as Dalpopa is not Buddhist, not because he's talking about Buddha nature, but because in some people's view, he's reifying it too much or making it into some kind of super Atman. And then that's just like a Hindu view. But of course, you know, one has to consider that, of course, there was a lot of, you know, sectarian rivalry, and to put some really bad label on something then is a tool to discredit some view, like right off the bat. You know, whether it's called, well, it's the Hindu teaching, or it's, you know, Hashang Mahayana problem. But that seems to be the main thing. And of course, some schools emphasize more emptiness in a particular sense, like emptiness as a non-affirmative negation or non-implicative negation. And of course, those schools are strongly against anything that sounds like, you know, Buddha nature is ultimately existent in any kind of way as, you know, whatever, obviously. But then, obviously, other people have different ideas about it. But in the Tibetan tradition, you can also see that even within the Kagyu tradition, there's quite some nuances in terms of what that means. And not all of Kagyu masters, for example, say that all the Buddha qualities exist totally right from the beginning. Like, there's some make a distinction between, yeah, the Dharmakaya qualities do exist innately, but the Rupakaya qualities actually, they're just like more like seeds, and they need to be, they grow on the path, versus, you know, somebody like Dolpopa or Taranatha or Tomin Kongtrul, who are, you could say, pretty hardcore. Well, it's all there right from the beginning, and you just need to uncover it. And these days, I think, for a lot of people in the Kagyu tradition in particular, I mean, they follow Tomin Kongtrul, as in so many other things, but he's actually not presenting the original previous Kamakaji view, like, for example, Third Kamapa, who differs from Dolpopa in several respects. So, but Tomin Kongtrul follows Taranatha primarily, which has some differences with, like, for example, Rangjung Dorje, and definitely with the Eighth Kamapa. So, but I think, yeah, the deal is basically about whether you just insist that emptiness is the be all end all, and then you have a problem with the qualities and the luminosity and all that stuff, especially if it sounds like it's reified, or you follow more the disclosure model. So there's the extreme pole of it's just emptiness, period, and then there's the other extreme, well, it's all the qualities are there already from the very beginning, but there's many shades in between in presentations of Tibetan masters, and I think there still is a lot of work to be done still to tease those out. Mm-hmm. Rather than going from, you know, just talking about from one extreme to the other.
Can you tease out for us a little bit this word luminosity? What's that all about and why is it so important?
Yeah, I think that word is a big problem. Because most people immediately think of it as something like light, you know, like a light bulb, basically, which is not it at all. So it's not something visual. So just to throw that in, a little anecdote, you know, a friend of mine in Germany, it was long ago, like he was fresh in Buddhism, and then the Dalai Lama came to Hamburg at the time, and he was his driver, you know, and he was very enthusiastic about the whole Buddhist thing, and Dalai Lama was also talking about clear light, you know, in his talks. And then, you know, my friend built his shrine at home and then sat down to meditate, and so I'm gonna get that clear light thing down now. So he, you know, lit the incense, the candle on his shrine and stuff, and he sat down and he's meditated with closed eyes, you know, and then suddenly he had this, everything became totally bright, you know. He said, oh wow, that's the clear light now, you know, and then suddenly he noticed a kind of weird smell, and then he saw that his shrine was in flames because the candle had lit the tanka and everything. So that's not luminosity. So it has nothing to do with, and it can have to do something with some inner brightness. It can, but not necessarily. So you could also, like a lot of times it's actually explained as more being like the natural purity of the mind. Like, for example, even in Pali sources, they talk about the luminosity of the mind and even afflictive adventitious stains. And also in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, for example, they use also luminosity, but in the sense of like purity, which means like stainlessness. Like, for example, if you go out on a clear winter day, like yesterday in Boulder, then, you know, you could say that is, everything's very clear, very bright, vivid, but not necessarily like just visually, but the whole thing is very crisp. Like when you breathe in the air, it's a very fresh, crisp feeling. So it's not limited to a visual thing at all. You could say it's the natural awareness or vibrancy or aliveness of the mind, basically, which is there all the time in any perception we have. It's integral to that. So the very fact that we are aware, you could say that's the luminosity, but of course it's kind of distorted or dimmed down in a sense.
Great.
But I think it's important to understand that it's not something visual. It's more like a it's an experiential vibrancy, which is there all the time, but then when it comes more to realizing the nature of the mind, it just this becomes exponentially more intense. To the point of, metaphorically speaking, outshining ordinary experiences, right? But it doesn't mean like you turn on a big spotlight or something. It's the intensity of the experience, not something visual. Like, for example, if you're overjoyed with something, right? That experience blots out everything else. Like you don't even see your surrounding, you don't have any thoughts, you don't even have an ego at that point, because it's so overwhelming. So, and that's what he also says in Vajrayana Mahamudra Rigpa. It just outshines everything. Not necessarily like the sun, but just to the power of the experience. There's no room for anything else.
Do you have any advice for students, practitioners who want to engage more with these teachings and with Maitreya teachings on Buddha nature? Any advice for those people, how they should start?
Yeah, I think it depends whether you are actually practitioner or you're just interested in the concept of Buddha nature, I mean, there's a lot of excellent materials out there, so it's hard to say, yeah, well, where to start, you know. And there's, of course, a lot of thick books. If you want something short, there's also a few ones there, and it's probably easier to begin with. I wouldn't want to recommend one over the other or something like that, but it definitely makes a difference whether you're a practitioner or an academic, and there's both. Mm-hmm. And I know, as I always try, is to kind of combine the two, which sometimes works, sometimes not so much. But I think Trungpa Rinpoche also has books on Buddha nature. I think those are nice, actually, as a starting point. Mm-hmm. Accessible. Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the people associated with the key teachings in Tibet and Tibetan history on Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. If there's any one or a few different figures you'd like to sort of point out to us as being particularly interesting or important.
Yeah, I think it wasn't such a big hot topic, really. I mean, the third Karmapa, I think, was, to my knowledge, the first one who actually, in a more substantial way, dealt with it. And that was almost at the same time as Dalpopa. And of course, Dalpopa was the big bang, I would say, in Tibet, in terms of, you know, Buddha nature teachings, in terms of his Shentong view, to which Buddha nature, I mean, that's the bedrock, basically. And of course, as we all know, he got a lot of flack for his approach because it was, at the time, extremely radical. And he used unknown terminology and presented things in a very, outspoken way. So I think, yes, Dalpopa is definitely one of the major figures, and the third Karmapa as well. Like, he wrote a treatise on Buddha nature, and also in his other writings, like, there's a commentary by him on the Nagarjuna's Dharmadhatu Stava that also talks a lot about Buddha nature teachings, and other texts by him. And then, of course, there's, Taranatha in the Jonang tradition, and Kagyu tradition, eighth Karmapa, definitely. Like, he wrote a text that is a digest on basically the fourth Vajra point of the Uttara Tantra in a more experiential manner, which is also translated in the When the Clouds Part. Gyaltsabche, definitely, in the Gelugpa tradition, major figure with his great commentary on the Uttara Tantra from a completely different point of view, but definitely milestone in Tibetan history on writings on Buddha nature. But I think in general, in the Gelugpa tradition, Buddha nature is not such a big deal. Way less than in Kagyu and Nyingma, basically, because it's considered a provisional teaching. Or as Gyaltsabche puts it, I mean, it's a Madhyamika, Prasangika, Madhyamika view teaching. Then, of course, Chaming Kongtrul, following largely Dalpopa Taranatha, but then also throwing in, like, he wrote some commentaries on the third Karmapa's Buddha nature text. Mipham Rinpoche to some extent, because, he said about himself, he's not a Shentongpa. Like he said, I don't have the burden to defend the Shentong view. But he wrote actually a commentary on the Uttara Tantra, and also he wrote an extensive text on basically those three reasons we were talking about, like positively, from a positive point of view, very different from the eighth Karmapa. So if you want to see those both sides of, you know, cutting it down and like really elaborately defending it, then you can look at the eighth Karmapa and Mipham Rinpoche in contrast. And Mipham Rinpoche's text, The Lion's Roar, on that is really excellent. Longchenpa, I would say yes, though of course he's known for his Dzogchen teachings, but if you look at his text, he talks extensively about Buddha nature. Like that's a big thing in, yeah, in his writings, definitely. Who else? There's probably other people. Oh yeah, of course, Gerlo Zauber. And I think, you know, again, Klaus Dieter Matthes brought that to the more wide public audience. And his commentary is really intriguing because, unique, because he is the only one I know that actually links the Uttaratan teachings to Mahamudra explicitly and repeatedly in different ways. So from that point, it's a very interesting approach, and his commentary is also very extensive, draws on a lot of sources, and even actually makes remarks about the Sanskrit of the Uttara Tantra and refers to different translations, which is quite interesting. So in many ways, you could say he's almost like a little bit into, you know, modern, comparing different editions, text critical analysis and stuff like that. And yeah, it would be great if it would be translated. I mean, Klaus Dieter started, but, and I talked to him and he said, yeah, he's still planning on doing that. So that would be great when that comes out, because that's a very unique Buddha nature view position that hasn't been highlighted in any other, you know, Western debate or that I know of, other than, yeah, Klaus Dieter's book and whatever I wrote in the clouds part. So yeah, that's, I think that's all I can think of right now. And of course in Sakya it's also not a big deal. I don't think there's a much going on there. Of course, yes, with one exception, Shakya Chokten. And he was a student of the seventh Karma and that Karmapa, and that's obviously when he changed his view or whatever, and also came into the Shantong camp. But his view is also very particular, and recently there has been some work done on that. Excellent work. So we know more about his position, but I think it's so complex in different texts that there's still way more work to be done. Mm. Like he wrote a whole text on just the five Maitreya texts, pretty long one. So yeah. And his Shantong interpretation is also very different from everybody else's. And it's said that even his opponents say his Shantong view is extremely hard to defeat. So I think that's the main persons I would think of.
Interesting. Can you think of any particularly interesting avenues of further research or topics that should be explored further? You started to mention a few just now that need to be explored. Yeah. Any other thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely Gerlo Zauber. I think Longchenpa would be very interesting to focus on his Buddha, the elements of on Buddha nature in his writings. And also basically tease out really the details of different masters' view, because it's not monolithic at all. Like in many cases, like, you know, it just goes with the Shantong, Rangtong distinction, basically, you know. It's also not just, okay, there's that position and that position. No, there's many nuances there. There's not just one Shantong, definitely. And there's not just one Buddha nature view, even within the Kagyu tradition. So I think it would be, also, I think it would be interesting to focus on other Sakya writers to see, you know, what is there. Are there any significant writings on Buddha nature, and how do they deal with it, apart from Shakya Chokten? So I think that would be interesting. And I'm sure there's some other, you know, figures. I mean, I came in the course of my studies, I came across some other Tibetan writers writing about Buddha nature. And so there's definitely much more to explore there.
What was the most sort of surprising thing you found in all that research? Is there any text or person or teaching you found that was...
Well, that there are actually texts that represent the meditative tradition. It's not just an oral thing, but there are actually texts that use the Uttara Tantra for Mahamudra style pointing out instructions. That was a major thing. And then connected to that, that a lot of them exist in the Kadampa tradition, which is not exactly obvious, right? yeah, and then also that commentary by Mapa Trigi Wangchuk, who does the same thing. That was also, and that I think it's actually one of the earliest commentary, like probably a little bit later than Ngoc's commentary, which we know is the earliest at this point, or at least preserved earliest. And that one is right up there. So that was, those were major finds and surprising finds. And also I think it was somewhat surprising that, you know, given the history about Maitripa being the rediscoverer, that there was virtually nothing in his writing or of his students, with the one exception of Vajrapani.
There's still the question about the attribution of the Uttara Tantra Shastra Vyakya to a Sangha, mm-hmm. and the history of all of that, which I guess is a little bit complex and fraught. But maybe you could just say a few words about what you think about how it even came about historically that the tradition is saying Sangha is the one who authored that text.
That is very hard to say. I have no definite answer to that at all. I mean, even in like the whole notion of the five texts of Maitreya is clearly Tibetan. In identifying the five they do, of course, obviously the Chinese also have five Maitreya texts, but some of them are different. but it seems that in India, at least at some point, a lot of people agreed that these five texts that the Tibetans identified were by Maitreya, but they didn't call them the five texts by Maitreya. But I would say I don't think there's any indication in Indian text that I know of, at least, that the Ratnagotra Vibhaga Vyakya was by a Sangha. There's a rather evidence to the contrary, because when they quote, they always refer to the text either as Ratnagotra Vibhaga. Vyakya is not, that's a retro translation, it's not found anywhere as a Sanskrit term. Or they call it Uttara Tantra. But even when they call it Uttara Tantra, they sometimes quote the prose part, which what is considered the commentary. So there's evidence that the text was considered as one, and there hasn't been any Sanskrit manuscript of just the verse portion that has been identified. It's just the whole thing, including the commentary. So there's more evidence actually in Indian text that it was one text altogether than evidence for it being a root text and a commentary. And also in the Chinese tradition, it is somewhat questionable that this was the case. When it came about in Tibet or who, I don't know. And, you know, it's one of those many things where you, maybe somebody could do some research on that. But I think also another strong point is what I mentioned before, like contra Asanga's authorship is, if you look at his other texts and the texts of other early Yogacara masters, they're all completely clear that it's Buddha nature is nothing but dhagme, like nairatmya, you know, that's it. Which is of course a completely different ball game than what you find in the Vyakya, right? So, and also Asanga's other texts, I mean, they never mentioned Buddha nature. Like, basically, you know, whether it's his Mahayana Samgra or any That's the only text attributed to him that even talks about Buddha nature. Like, he never mentions it anywhere else. So it makes you wonder, at least, right? So, but of course, Tibetan tradition attributes it to Asanga. But, you know, many things are attributed to all kinds of people in both India and Tibet, which from a, let's say, more critical academic Western point of view are not tenable. So in the end, I think it's sometimes hard to decide really who wrote something, because it's a common Indian tradition to attribute texts to famous authors to lend them more weight and stuff like that. Like, you know, all these things like today, you know, the Buddha said, which, like, the fake Buddha quotes, you know, it sounds better if somebody famous said it. So I don't know, but from what I know, there seems to be more evidence that suggests that the text was a unit. Whoever composed it, that's also not clear at all, rather than a root text and then a later commentary.
Interesting. So if you imagine a young student out there in the world interested in Buddhism but not having studied very much yet, coming upon the idea of Buddha nature, can you speak to that person and just tell them what's the most important or interesting thing about learning about Buddha nature? Why study it?
Well, I guess you could say because it's the nature of your own mind. It's, you could say it's your deepest being, so to speak. In a sense, conventionally speaking, it's who you truly are without you. So it sounds paradoxical, but, you know, I guess in a sense you could say it's your true self. And of course, if you go into more detail, then of course obviously it's not that, but conventionally speaking, like, that's who you really are, or that's who everybody really is from a Buddhist point of view. And I think it's interesting in that it's very, you know, different from, like, the Judeo-Christian model of, you know, the, you know, what's it called? Hereditary sin, or whatever you call it. Original sin, which says basically you essentially your nature is bad, and then you have to upgrade, right? You have to become good, or God has to save you. So in Buddhism, it's different. It says, or in Buddha nature teaching, it says you're essentially good. There is no problem with you at all. You just have to get that. So slightly different view here. But I think, especially in this day and age, you know, where there's a lot of self-doubt and self-deprecation and depression and stuff like that, you know, I think it can be quite helpful, actually, to, you know, engage in that, or to at least, you know, see, oh, yeah, well, you know, there's, people have a different view on this, you know, and, you know, explore that. I think it can be helpful.
Great. All right. Wonderful. Thank you so much. That's really great.
Yeah, thank you. All right.